Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1980 Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. And as I do, I'm talking about the deities therein, their mythology, and how to use them in games. In our last episode, we did a little bit more about Norse mythology, and we ended talking about the god Frey, one of the Vanir, the other tribe of deities in Norse mythology. In this episode, we're going to start with Frey's twin sister, Freya, and then we're going to move on to some other deities, starting with Frigga, the wife of Odin, and then, depending on how much time we have, talking about Garm the Hellhound, and maybe Heimdall, the guardian of the Rainbow Bridge. So let's get started. Okay, we start off with Freya. Now, Freya has a pretty, like, easily defined divine responsibility. That is to say, she is the goddess of love. But you will be astonished to hear, by this point, that it's not really that simple. In general, when you got a major goddess like Freya, she's seldom confined to kind of one area of responsibilities. So while she is certainly the goddess of love, she's also got a couple of other responsibilities. And she's just a major goddess who looks out maybe particularly for the interests of women, but not necessarily. So what do we know about Freya? Well, I mentioned before that she is the twin sister of Frey. And together with their father Njord, they're basically the representatives of the Vanir among the Æsir. Heimdall may be one of the Vanir, I think, but it's not ever really made clear. It has sometimes been suggested that Freya is actually the same deity as Frigg, and this is largely because she has kind of a cipher husband. So she's married to this guy named Odd, whose name does come from the same root word as Odin. And Odd goes down to Earth and wanders around a lot, and he's seldom home, and Freya cries because she misses her husband and can't find him, and her tears are gold. And the only real thing, the only way in which Odd is important is that his name occurs in poetic kennings for Freya. So poetic kennings are, we talked about these before, but they're basically sort of metaphors or elliptical ways to refer to things. And one kenning for Freya is Odd's girl, or Odd's wife. But other than that, I don't think Odd is terribly important. And because they both have names that start with fur, and because, you know, Freya's husband might be Odin, it's sometimes suggested that Freya and Frigg are the same deity. But what I think we can say when we examine the Norse pantheon is that for gaming purposes, we don't need to think about them that way. If you had to say that Freya and Frigg are different aspects of the same deity, right? That Freya is the younger, you know, maybe the unmarried woman, and then Frigg represents, like, the older, wiser woman, I guess you could make that argument. But for our purposes, whether or not they originated from the same place, their roles have become so distinct from each other that there's no need to combine them. Now, like her brother, Freya is pretty impressively tooled up. She has a chariot, which is drawn by two cats. She has a cloak, which turns her into a bird. It says in the Deities and Demigods book that she can just turn into a bird, but she sometimes lends this ability to others. So she seems to wear a cloak made of feathers that gives her the ability to shapeshift into a bird, typically a falcon, but possibly any kind of bird. But so she lends it to Loki. She also has a very valuable necklace, Brisingamen, which gets stolen at one point, and Heimdall has to go and get it back. You've just noticed that Freya's necklace gets stolen, and Heimdall has to go and get it back. Loki borrows her bird cloak. And at one point, Thor goes off to Giantland disguised as Freya to fool the giants who want to fool a giant who wants to marry her. And giants want to marry Freya is a recurring theme in Norse mythology. But what you'll have noticed about all these stories is that Freya herself doesn't actually do a whole lot. She turns up at things, and she kind of blesses things, and she wrangles with Loki in Lokasenna, in which he accuses her of being promiscuous, and indeed accuses her of having had a relationship with her own brother, Frey, which might have a relationship to something that we talked about last time, the idea that Njord and his first wife might have been brother and sister, so there may be the idea that that's something that the Vanir do that the Æsir don't consider acceptable, but who knows? But so Freya herself doesn't necessarily do a whole lot. She's not a go-get-stuff-done character like Thor. She's a get-stuff-done-for-her character like Frey. And I want to argue that from the perspective of a role-playing game, this is actually preferable. Frey and Freya both have these stories in which agents accomplish missions for them, and that's a really good way to model the relationship between a deity and their clerics and paladins. So Freya is said to answer prayers relating to love and marriage, and sort of love affairs, matters of the heart. And it would be a lot of fun for her clerics to be sent out to deal with these kinds of things, you know. In particular, the idea that she's looking for her lost love. So people who have lost their love, she might have particular sympathy for them and ask her clerics to go and help them. Whereas it's harder to imagine the missions that clerics of Thor go on, because Thor is the guy who goes on missions. If there's a problem, Thor gets sent out to deal with it. So maybe clerics of Thor find themselves accomplishing missions for clerics of Odin? Anyway, Freya is a pretty powerful deity. Her name just means the lady, just like Frey just means a lord. Indeed, I think it's related to Frau, right? Lady. And we are told that she receives half of all the slain who die in battle. You know, Odin gets half and Freya gets the other half. And she has a little domain of her own. All the gods seem to have their own little territories, and hers is called Folkvang, which means the field of the people, or maybe the field of the army, or warrior's field, but folk means folk, and vang means field. And her hall is there, and it's called Sesrumnir, which means have many seats, so it's large. So she has a large and impressive hall, she has a big territory, and she gets half of those who die in battle. So she, in fact, may have her own Valkyries, or she may herself be some kind of Valkyrie, like a super Valkyrie, right? Because if she collects the slain, then, you know, either the Valkyries bring them to Asgard and separate them, half for Freya and half for Odin, or there are Valkyries who work directly for Freya, which again would be a fun model for Freya's paladins. Now, you may realize that we now have more than 100% of the slain who die in battle, because Odin gets half, Freya gets half, but then also Harbard said that Odin gets the nobles who die in battle, but Thor gets the slaves. So it seems like your fate in the afterlife in Norse mythology is quite complex. There are a lot of different places you could go, and no one can quite agree on where you'll end up. This is sure true, as we will find out when we come to talk about Hel, the goddess of death. Okay, so we mentioned the bird cloak, the Breezing Necklace, and the chariot drawn by cats. One thing that is missing from this account of Freya is that, like her brother, she too has a pig. Frey has his boar Gullinbursti, gold bristles, and she has a boar called Hildisvini, battle swine. And that seems like a shameful oversight in my view. More games would be better with battle swine in them. So Freya plays a really big role in a lot of Norse myths, often as an object of desire. So being able to marry Freya is something that a lot of people want, and what they usually get instead is dead. That she was important in early medieval Scandinavian religious practice, again, it's really hard to infer much about what religion meant on a day-to-day basis from the mythological sources that we have, but there is some evidence to suggest that Freya was considered important, and that she was associated with what happens to you after you die. So for example, in Egil's saga, Egil is contemplating suicide as a result of the death of his son, which we mentioned earlier when we talked about Odin, and his daughter, Thorgerd, decides to join him, basically as a way of shaming him out of it. And someone offers her something to drink, and she says, "Oh, I'll drink no more until I sit with Freya," or something like that. I'm doing it from memory, but so she thinks that she's going to get to go to Freya when she dies, even though she's not going to die in battle. So maybe there's an idea that that's where women go when they die. Now, this is very interesting because you would think, right, you would think if we were going to have a gender-separated heaven and a gender-separated afterlife, that the obvious pairing would be Odin and his wife, Frigg, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So Freya seems to be the one who represents a kind of feminine interest among the gods. Goddesses, Asynjur, often come with a paired male deity. So, for example, Odin and Frigg, but both Frey's wife Gerd and Freya's husband Odd are not super important, and therefore we can think of Frey as being Freya's paired male deity. What else? She's got two daughters. Her one daughter is called Hnoss, which means treasure, and her other daughter is called Yersemi, or I'm probably mispronouncing that, but that also means treasure. So the idea that she is sort of a granter of riches seems to be important. Again, we saw the image that when she cries, her tears are golden. So we can imagine her shrines being very spectacular, lots of gold decoration, her clerics covered in gold, maybe quite different from We can imagine the clerics of Odin being rather severe and austere, like their gray-haired old patron deity. Or the clerics of Thor, when we get to them, being sort of rough-and-ready types. But I think that the sense of kingship that you get in Frey, and the idea that Freya is someone who weeps gold, would suggest that their clerics would be rather spectacular. In the medieval and post-medieval periods, Freya kind of winds up becoming basically Venus. Not that she wasn't close to it anyway, but she becomes very much understood as a love goddess, and I think that there's definitely a sense in which you can say that she's one to begin with, particularly with the idea that she is beloved, that she's the one who is desired, and everyone's always kind of wanting to marry her, despite the fact that she's already married. I don't know why the giants don't catch on to that bit. And they're giants, I guess. Not terribly bright, or maybe they just think that her husband is dead. He's missing. Anyhow, Freya is a pretty great patron for a cleric, because I think she provides a lot of adventure opportunities, kind of like Frey does. She's associated with all these other things, like with war and death, but kind of so are a lot of Norse deities, so the distinctive thing about her is certainly her focus on love and affairs of the heart. Finally, just to look at her illustration, we've got another illustration by Jeff D., again, in kind of a, you know, 70s-y comic book-y kind of a style. It's not bad. I note that she has pointy ears, again, suggesting that she's an elf, like her brother Frey, who is, of course, the god of elves. Okay, then let's talk about Frigg. Here she's called Frigga, and that's often something that you get in modern texts. It has no basis in her name, which is just Frigg, but it's done for two reasons. One, to make it sound a little bit less like a dirty word, and two, to make it sound more feminine, because we tend to think of names that end in A as being feminine from, I guess, like a Latin influence. That's not necessarily true in Old Norse, but you will often see Frigg called Frigga, and sometimes you'll see Idun called Iduna. And I think that's just to make them sound more like what we would expect a woman's name to be like. Anyway, Frigg is particularly associated with wisdom and divination. In the Lokasenna, when Loki is insulting all the gods, people tell him that he must be crazy to insult Frigg because she can see the fates of everyone there. So right away, we get the idea of someone who, like Odin, is associated with divination and fortune-telling, and we get the idea that a priestess of Frigg or a temple of Frigg might be somewhere that you would go looking for answers to your questions. And indeed, it's sometimes said that her foreknowledge is actually greater than Odin's. There are cases of her sort of manipulating Odin into doing things, and of bringing matters to Odin's attention that he doesn't know about, and even ones where she and Odin kind of wager on the outcome of affairs in Midgard. You know, they'll sort of back different candidates or different heroes in a story and see which one does better. So you might find yourself being supported by Frigg because the person that you're up against is supported by Odin. And remember our analysis of Odin and what he's like. Being backed by Odin does not make you the good guy. Frigg is kind of a better choice in that respect. She's probably less awful than her husband. Frigg is interesting. There is a mention in the Poetic Edda where Frigg is at one point married to both of Odin's brothers, Vili and Ve. And that's because Odin is away. He's missing. And while he's gone, his brothers divide up his inheritance, but they can't divide Frigg, so they share her. Now, I don't know if there's a particular meaning here, but it seems to be that Frigg is kind of an indispensable part of rulership. If you're going to be the king, you have to be, you know, if you want Odin's power, an important part of that is his wife and her, presumably her foretelling abilities. So they don't want to give the advantage of having her to just one of them. But then Odin comes back and she just remarries him and it doesn't seem to be a big deal. Another interesting thing is that we have a great deal of background on how Odin got his abilities of foresight. He goes through this whole process, basically a kind of, you know, death and rebirth, sacrifice, initiatory process to gain his ability to see the future. But there's no explanation of where Frigg got hers. She just has it. Deities and Demigods book calls her the goddess of the atmosphere, something that I have absolutely no evidence for. I don't know where that came from. The idea that she's kind of a goddess of the heavens, I really don't know why you would say that. Maybe there's something I'm overlooking. But as far as I can tell, she's just, her main thing is seeing the future and kind of, you know, being the queen of the gods. She is a goddess who has a lot of kind of images and themes associated with motherhood, but not necessarily in the kind of nurturing way that you might expect, but specifically in grief. Of course, Frigg's son with Odin, Baldr, is killed, as we discussed in the entry on Baldr, and she is heartbroken. She's the one who attempted to protect him. She's the one who tries to get him back by sending another of her sons, Hermod, down into hell to find out what's going on. And when the wolf finally kills Odin, this is called Frigg's second great sorrow. So the idea that part of a mother's experience is defined as grieving for her children gives us something of a picture of the fragility of life in this setting. And the idea that woe is part of everyone's experience. There's a poem about Gudrun, and its title is sometimes translated as Gudrun's Chain of Woes. All the different family members and her lover and her children who have died. And it's just kind of a lament for them. So Frigg as kind of like a mournful goddess, not nearly the kind of upbeat and outgoing character that Freya is, gives us kind of an image of what those priestesses would be like, right? Quite somber and serious, using their divination perhaps for the good of the community, but maybe in kind of a ruthless way. If you read the Icelandic sagas, there are certainly these characters, these kind of matriarchs, who appear, who are wise and do a lot of planning and kind of manage their families with a kind of cold-blooded practicality, or who are willing to go to great lengths to protect or avenge their children. And again, I think we can see that in the character of Frigg. So she's a mother goddess, yes, but not one of your nurturing, bountiful mother goddesses, rather a strict and stern mother goddess who nonetheless loves her children. I don't know that such a cleric would be a whole lot of fun to play, but it would be a bit different from the usual kind of, you know, out, foul, undead, bash him with the mace type, but someone who was more interested in the kind of divination aspects of clerical magic and in using those to, you know, plan and structure things. It's quite interesting. So that's Frigg, and I think she's got a lot of potential, maybe more as a setting feature or a background character, rather than someone whose clerics and paladins go out on adventures, but definitely someone that you would pray to for wisdom and guidance. All right, next up we got Garm. Garm is a hound. He's the best of hounds, according to the Poetic Edda, and he is maybe the guardian of the gate of the underworld. There is a hound in the underworld. Sometimes it's Garm. Sometimes it's just called a hound. And he, like Fenrir, sometimes he's assumed to be identical to Fenrir. Sometimes he's not. Like Fenrir, he is restrained. And like Fenrir, he will break free at Ragnarok. Garm occurs three times in the Völuspá. And each time it signals the beginning of another sort of phase of Ragnarok. So it's sort of a refrain in which Garm's howling and the prophetess's prophetic powers are mentioned. Again, this is from the Andy Orchard translation, where he translates most of the place names and things into their literal English meanings. Garm howls loud before looming cave. The bond will break and the ravenous one run. Much lore she knows, I see further ahead, of the power's fate, implacable of the victory gods. And then she goes on to explain the beginning of Ragnarok, the Fimbulvetr, the endless winter. Again, you know, I grew up with the Patricia Terry translation, which just reads, Garm bays loudly outside Nipa cave, his rope will break, and he will run free. So you can see why people thought that this was associated with Fenrir. In fact, Garm is scheduled, fated, to fight Tyr, the war god, who we last saw being the guy getting his hand bitten off by Fenrir. So you'd think that Fenrir and Tyr would be enemies, but in fact, of course, Fenrir is going to kill Odin, and in turn be killed by Vidar. So Garm is going to attack Tyr, and Tyr is going to kill him, but also die in the fight. And if the wolf who appears in Baldr's Draum is, or the hound, I should say, who appears in that poem, is Garm, then he's particularly associated with being bloody. His name may come from an Old Norse word that means rag, which is kind of cool. Okay, so again, Garm is a little bit like Fenrir. I mean, he's basically just a big, fierce monster. He's not a god in the sense of, you know, being worshipped and having clerics and having paladins and stuff like that. Just something you might encounter on an underworld journey. Kind of like Cerberus in that respect. And he's often compared to Cerberus. One of the problems we have with Norse mythology is that later writers were often at pains to make it kind of equivalent to Greek mythology. So if they go, oh, well, Freya's kind of like Aphrodite, then they'll make Freya into Aphrodite, and it's a bit of a nuisance. Finally, we have Heimdall. Heimdall has kind of become more famous ever since he became a major character in the Thor movies, as played by Idris Elba. And Heimdall is the watchman of the gods. He's the guardian of the Bifrost, the rainbow bridge that connects Asgard and Midgard. Or indeed, Asgard and everywhere, I guess. And he is a bit of a stiff. You get the impression that Heimdall is rather a stern, dutiful figure. He doesn't do an enormous amount. He is the one who goes and gets the Breezing Necklace back for Freya. And he's known for his perceptive power. So it's said that he can hear grass growing. And anything that happens anywhere in the world, he can see. Yeah, Loki taunts him, saying, again, this is the Andy Orchard translation, "Shut your mouth, Heimdall. In ancient days for you was a grim life laid down. With muddy back you must ever be, and watch as the guard of the gods." Loki seems to think that Heimdall's sort of sentry duty is this, you know, grim task that he has to uphold. But I gotta say, it actually doesn't sound so bad. Heimdall lives in a hall called Himinbjörg, which means something like Heaven Fortress, or maybe Heaven Mountain. There he drinks fine mead and just kind of hangs out. So clearly he's got a permanent setup going. Now, he does sometimes come down to Earth. In fact, he's supposed to be the creator of the different social classes among mankind. And there's sometimes reference to humans as Heimdall's sons. So he may be this this character called Rig, who basically goes around having children with different women, and with each woman he has these different children who go on to populate a different social class. So, like, you know, he goes to a warrior's household, and then the woman becomes pregnant, and then, you know, he goes to a farmer's household, and so on and so on. I don't know why particularly that's Heimdall, but the sense of Heimdall as a defender or protector is a pretty strong one, and you can definitely see how he would be a good god to have for a kind of paladin character, right? We've talked about Tyr as the war god. I mean, we'll get to him when we get to him, but you can see a paladin of Tyr being a guy who, you know, goes around, you know, doing battle and the name of the gods, or a paladin of Forseti as someone who enforces justice and upholds the law, and a paladin of Heimdall would be someone who protects, someone who defends the community, who defends the innocent against threats. And if you're playing something like 5th edition, where you have the different paladin oaths, the different gods kind of correspond well to those. So Heimdall would be the neutral one, I guess. So Heimdall, yeah, he has a magic sword, which is called Hofud, which means head. And there are a couple references to Heimdall's head being a sword. I don't know. I may have got that from Hilda Ellis Davison. And now, Hilda Ellis Davison's Gods and Myths of Northern Europe is fantastic reading, but is also speculative. Let's call it speculative. And so from there, I sort of think she suggests that, you know, Heimdall's head is a sword, and that may mean that Heimdall has kind of the attributes of a ram, but I don't know where else that comes from. And so you can't quite trust these. So he has also a magic horn, the Gjallar horn, which means the resounding horn or the echoing horn, and it is the horn that will be blown to warn of the beginning of Ragnarok. And figures who are depicted with horns are sometimes said to be Heimdall. Now, you remember when Loki was making fun of Heimdall in Lokasenna, and is sometimes suggested that Heimdall and Loki are rivals in general, although I don't know of any other examples, but Heimdall is probably the biggest law-abiding stiff in Asgard, so you can see how he would be a tempting target for Loki. But at Ragnarok, it's Heimdall who will kill Loki, and Loki will kill him in return. And if he does have this power of foresight, which is a power that he uses, by the way, to suggest dressing up Thor as Freya and sending him to a giant's wedding to retrieve his stolen hammer, he would presumably know that, which would lend his argument with Loki a particularly tragic character. Anyway, Heimdall is basically one of a number of sort of buff, fighty types with a distinctive superpower, and he really makes sense as a patron deity for clerics or paladins who are interested in defending. And if you could give them some kind of perception power, that would be pretty cool. Other than that, there isn't an enormous amount to him. Although he is mentioned, the thing about Norse mythology is there's a lot of lists and there's a lot of features of the different gods, but that don't necessarily appear in narratives. We don't have a huge number of poems or tales of which Heimdall is the protagonist or even in which he plays an important role. We've got the one where he creates the different classes of mankind, and there's also the story about him, you know, fighting Loki in the form of a seal to retrieve the Breezing Necklace, and then that's kind of it. Other than that, he sort of shows up in catalogs. So we have a lot of information about these gods, but maybe not necessarily a whole lot of myths about them. Heimdall is an example of that. He's quite enigmatic. For example, we know that he's called the whitest of the gods, or the brightest of the gods. The actual word is white, fit. But what that means, I couldn't tell you. This, incidentally, is, if you played Werewolf the Apocalypse, that's why the swords of Heimdall are the skinheads, the racist werewolves, because Heimdall is the white god, and they like things that are white, even though Heimdall presumably wouldn't like werewolves. Never mind, eh? So I hope that that's been a fun look at a couple of different characters in Norse mythology and how you might wind up using them in your games. We've got a couple more episodes of Norse myth left. In our next episode, we're going to take a look at Hel, the goddess of death, who's got a lot going on. Particularly, we can kind of compare her to her recent appearance in Thor Ragnarok. And I will say that they are quite different. Still, though, a lot of fun to be had there, and depending on how much time we have, we'll take a look at a few other deities and legendary beings as well. So please join me next time for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.